Welcome back to the Expert Witness Playbook, the podcast where we help expert witnesses, attorneys, and legal professionals navigate the complex world of litigation. I'm your host, Dr. Brian Woodruff, pediatric neurologist and expert witness. In each episode, we explore the strategies, tools, and insights that help experts strengthen their opinions, communicate more effectively, and make a greater impact in the courtroom. Today, we're talking about a resource that is often cited, frequently debated, and sometimes misunderstood, the medical literature. In cases involving medical malpractice, personal injury, wrongful death, product liability, and mass torts, the scientific evidence can play a pivotal role in shaping case strategy and expert testimony. But finding the right literature and understanding what it actually says can be a challenge. My guest today is Michael Graham, a medical and scientific research consultant who specializes in helping attorneys, legal nurse consultants, and expert witnesses find, evaluate, and apply the best available medical evidence. Michael has more than 20 years of experience as a medical librarian and researcher, including 2 decades supporting clinicians within major healthcare systems. He also brings experience as a law librarian and litigation-focused medical researcher, giving him a unique perspective at the intersection of medicine, science, and law. Today, we'll discuss how medical literature searches can strengthen expert opinions, common pitfalls in evaluating scientific studies, and practical approaches for finding the evidence that matters most in medically complex litigation. Michael, welcome to the Expert Witness Playbook.
Yeah, thank you so much, Brian, for having me. I've really been looking forward to our conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, I know at our sort of intro meeting, I got excited about getting to talk with you, and you know, it's always fun to talk about something a little different, and I think this is a little different than just talking to another expert, and I'm really trying to bring on more guests that can kind of bring different perspectives. So I think I'd love to just start out by just understanding how you became involved in medical legal research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. So, like you'd mentioned, I'd been a medical librarian meeting the information needs of a large medical group and healthcare system for 20 years. And 8 years ago, I had an agency reach out to me completely out of the blue. I wasn't looking for this work, didn't know it was a thing or a need. And they said, hey, we have a small boutique law firm. They have 3 attorneys, and they're really mired in a very medically complicated med mal case. A medical device had failed. The physician didn't recognize that it had failed, and they persisted on with the treatment, and this patient was harmed. So there's a lot of finger pointing, as you can imagine, you know, the medical device manufacturers saying, not our fault. We have training and all of these warnings. The physician and the healthcare system is pointing the finger back at the medical device manufacturer. And this boutique law firm, they didn't have the bandwidth to do a systematic, comprehensive literature search. They weren't confident that they had found even close to what they needed. And it was pulling their attention away from working on what they really needed to be focused on, which was legal strategy, getting their experts, you know, prepared and everything. So they had me do a bunch of systematic reviews, searches, and pull, you know, all of the pertinent stuff together, and then, you know, pull all the literature from the opposition's experts. And I had such a great time. It was so, you know, challenging and just intellectually interesting. I went back to the agency and I said, I love that experience. You know, any other work you can find for me will be great. And then, you know, like a lot of folks in our space, it was kind of slow going and a few cases a year for a little bit until I started my own LLC.
Yeah, that's universal with everybody in this. And we've talked about that in a lot of other mm-hmm. podcasts. It's pretty rare for people to hit the ground running. It's sort of a trickle to start with, and then mm-hmm. and then it gets going. How long, Michael, how long ago was that when that first case?
Yeah, it's been 8 years now. Yeah, it's been a little while.
Yeah, and so obviously things been getting busier. I know we met on what I remember on LinkedIn, and I'm on there a little bit, and there are a lot of other people on there. But so for attorneys or experts that may not have worked with a medical librarian before, what exactly do you do? Kind of walk us through what you do in a medical malpractice or injury case.
Yeah, so I'll do a comprehensive or exhaustive literature search to make sure that every piece of evidence and study and guidelines and textbook chapters and all that good stuff, it's identified and then given, to the, the attorneys or the expert or the LNC, and then they can make, informed decisions. They know what the evidence says. And so that can, that can work in a and I come in to a bunch of different types of cases, and I can come in very early in the process. Like if an attorney is on the fence about taking a case and they're like, hey, I really want to understand why did this happen to this patient and, their kind of journey, or maybe there's a very complicated causation argument where it's like, it's not just A to B, it's A caused B, caused C, caused D. And there's just, they really want to know that they have this kind of mini library at their disposal to just do a deep dive. And so, yeah, I'm just trained in the systematic searching and identifying of these sources and getting access to all of this good stuff for folks.
A lot of us were sort of trained to go out there and we hit PubMed and we type in our keywords, and I got a feeling that's just scratching the surface. I don't know. I graduated from medical school, almost 30 years ago, and it still feels like we're doing the same literature searches that we were back then. Obviously, your services are out there, but for somebody that is sort of starting a search, where would you point them to, sort of to get, hoping that they can do a little bit on their own before they may contact you? What are sort of the three best things that you can do to kind of kick off your search if you're trying to do some of it yourself to start with?
Yeah, great question. So yeah, a database selection is really important, like you hinted at. PubMed is the go-to for like medical and scientific. If you do just a Google search, that's a you're not going to find really even a fraction of what's out there. And that search algorithm, or that search engine, it's in a black box. Like I could put in terms, you could put in terms, and we could get very different results.
You're
And
talking
Google, with
with
Google,
Google getting, yeah, there's so many variables that play into that. So
Absolutely.
Google would be a start, but that would be one thing. I think we talked about PubMed.
Yeah, PubMed. Yeah, so that would be the go-to. And then kind of the next thing I would recommend for people doing research would be to identify all of your key terms. So make sure you've identified all your synonyms around, a disease or a procedure, related terms. Just make sure that you've identified all of those. And then you're going to want to think of like kind of downstream concepts that could come into play. If a lot of times, like some medical terms or procedures, they go out of vogue. It's not called this anymore, it's called that. So yeah, you're going to want to kind of just open up a Word document and make sure you're getting all of those terms pulled in.
Do you tend to do that for people, or are you kind of are hoping that when they engage you that they may present some of that to you to start with? Kind of, is that kind of a combination?
No, I typically do that, for people, and I always provide search strategies. It'll show like exactly what I did and all the terms I used. So yeah, I can identify all of those, and usually if the requester, the more context they give me, the better, and the different terms that they have identified and things like that.
Okay, so they can go. So the first thing I heard, they can go to Google. You're going to scratch the surface, get into PubMed, but really, it may take lots and lots of synonyms and you're kind of trying to put combinations together. Are there other places that you tend to have people look that aren't sort of typical? If you can kind of go in, into anywhere else that may be a place to look.
You know, a lot of the best databases are just off limits for most folks. You know, it's like Web of Science, Scopus. These are databases that aren't generally available to the public. So, I mean, Google Scholar, if somebody just, they don't have access to these great tools, Google Scholar is just a subset of Google that'll look at just kind of journals and textbooks and stuff. And again, that's still a black box. So like you said, it's still just going to be scratching the surface, but at least it's not going to pull up like a blog or an advertising website. So,
right. So those other that aren't as easily accessible, those are things as a librarian that you either subscribe to or have access to in your sort of in your professional capacity.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
So can you give an example of how medical literature can change direction of a case, either by strengthening a theory or revealing weaknesses? What have you found in the past?
Yeah, great question. So kind of one good example I have is I wasn't paid to be part of this case. I just identified it with public records and then I wrote it up as a case study for my Substack. But it was a prime example of the impact that literature can have. So this case was it was alleging that a probe had caused a specific injury, perforation. There was two amazing sets of experts, highly qualified. Their CVs were a mile long. You know, department chairs published everything, and the one set was saying, "Absolutely not. This probe could never have caused this injury." The other set, of course, were saying, yes, it could have, but nobody cited anything. And during the depositions, they said, I'm really not aware of any literature, or I looked and I couldn't find it. So I did a systematic search and I found that there actually was six case studies or series that looked exactly at this. It was same procedure, same technology, caused a nearly identical perforation. And that would have, you know, in that case, that would have bolstered, you know, the plaintiff's claim that, yes, this can happen. And even some of the literature said, when this, you do see this, it's human error is the cause. So that could have tipped the scale there. And then, you know, for like,
Yeah. Well, specific to that one, do you think that they, well, maybe they were going from their memory that they had never seen any literature. Did you find that literature through standard methods, or were you had to go through some of your different pathways to get to those six studies?
Yeah, it was a tough search. I would not expect any clinician to ever be able to find these. I had to use some kind of proprietary tools to really go deep down a rabbit hole. Some of them weren't tagged correctly, so PubMed really wasn't going to find them with the traditional. Even another medical librarian would have missed some of these. So it's unreasonable in that case to expect, you know, most folks to have found those. But yeah, you know, it was exciting and fun and interesting to track those down.
So I guess that kind of ties into sort of what do you see as some of the common mistakes that either experts make or attorneys make when using medical literature in litigation, either mistakes they do in trying to find it or once they have it? What, I guess that's a two-part question.
Yeah. So I do see a lot of folks, whether they're, you know, experts, LNCs or attorneys, misusing studies. You know, they'll cite something, but if you really look at the study, it doesn't quite say what they claim it says, or it's not like a great comparison. You know, the patient population's different, the procedure's different. I had an attorney reach out to me, and their expert had received a Daubert challenge that was focused on their methodology, and they the opposition had attached two systematic reviews to that challenge, saying, you know, hey, these systematic reviews back up what we're saying. And when I looked at them, it was pretty laughable how just far out of left field these were pertaining to this case. Like the case was an American male in his 50s, had an inpatient knee surgery. Both of these systematic reviews, they looked great at first glance, but they were Chinese. So, and in those studies, that it was an outpatient procedure. So it's different patient population, outpatient versus inpatient in China versus US, different healthcare system, different physician trainings, different standard of care. It was like, it wasn't even apples to oranges. It was like apples to potatoes. So that was a pretty gross misuse of that literature. So I see, yeah, kind of a lot of misunderstandings like that, or yeah, just the patient scenario is just not applicable to.
Yeah. Well, Daubert, for those, Daubert challenges, not being a lawyer, but that strikes fear in all of us as experts, because they're Daubert is my understanding is sort of the federal, but a lot of states also use the same standards. But there it's as it relates to your trying to throw out, make your methodology that you didn't use proper methodology and to get your opinions basically struck or thrown out. So I can see where bringing in somebody with your skill set and expertise could be super important and money super well spent because those are some really high stakes encounters and usually get one crack at it. You often in Daubert challenges, from what I've read, there's a challenge and then a response, and then often you go in front of a judge for actual testimony to sort of argue your case. So, and a lot of literature is often a big part of those. So, have Daubert challenges been something that frequently comes up in your practice?
I've only had attorneys kind of reach out to me for that help a little bit. They tend to,
Okay.
I see them in cases I'm actually n have nothing to do with, and I'm just intellectual curiosity. I'll look up the documents on PACER and I'll study them, and some of them are fascinating. Yeah, it's just there's no systematic literature searching going on. And yeah, there was like a multi-district litigation case I came across, and the experts didn't do their own searches, and the attorneys just handed them a packet of what they wanted them to look at. So it's really hard to kind of claim that you're neutral or objective in that
Yeah, no, I
scenario.
can. Yeah, if you're just hand, it's kind of like you're just being told what to say. Yeah. How should legal teams think about levels of evidence as far as case reports, observational studies, systematic reviews, guidelines when building an argument? Because, the gold standard we always talk about is double blinded control trial. Obviously, we can't have that for everything. Sometimes that's unethical. So, as you're talking, physicians and legal nurse consultants probably understand this more, but attorneys and those that are not trained in medicine may not really understand the power or how good these different, like I said, case, observational, systematic reviews. Maybe you can help kind of walk them through that.
Yeah, so some good kind of general rules are, there's a little evidence pyramid, and we kind of see that all over the internet. And at the top, you have, guidelines, and then you have these amazing high quality systematic reviews and meta-analyses like Cochrane or maybe something
I
that's
was going to
appearing.
bring that up. The Cochrane is like those are I just find those so helpful. So for people that are out there, I think we should pause there and just it's just tell people a little nugget about Cochrane reviews and because they've been out a long time and I think they're underutilized.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and like you said, Brian, they're the gold standard. They are so massive and exhaustive, and they're very transparent in their methodology. They just look at everything, and there's just so much complexity and nuance that they tackle. And they're put out in England, Britain, and a lot of folks, they're not like these big theoretical or hypothetical things. They're going to implement directly their findings into their healthcare system. So they have to get those findings right and really consider everything very carefully. Because it isn't just like we're going to do a systematic review, it's theoretical, read it, take it or leave it, think about it. They're going to implement that over, 100 plus million, people in the UK to really influence.
Right.
So,
And it's things like, what's the current, how should we be treating hypertension? How should we be treating type 2 diabetes? Things that I've come across in my field as a pediatric neurologist is therapeutic hypothermia and sort of all the evidence. And that one is just phenomenal that goes through. And it just, it like, there's no spin on it either. It just feels very down the middle, so the Cochrane. But anyway, we got off on I always get off on tangents. So this pyramid we were talking about with guidelines and the systematic reviews, those really tight ones being at the top.
Yeah, and then kind of in the middle, you have these large cohort studies and observational studies, and those tend to be huge data sets. It's not looking at a couple patients or a couple little treatments. It's like thousands, tens of thousands, can be millions even. So you have this massive data set. Then when you get down toward the bottom, you have case series. So there might be like 40 patients that went through this procedure or had this, event happen. Then you get into the little case studies where it's like two people, two patients. And then below that, you have just, letters and editorials and opinion pieces. It's one person writing in saying, this is what I think, and this is my background. So, yeah, so that's kind of the evidence pyramid and the strength and kind of reliability of those different sources.
Yeah, let's shift gears because I love talking about AI. I don't know enough about it. And it seems like every time I'm at a coffee shop or at a bar having a beer, I overhear somebody, I mean, just lay people talking about AI. And 6 months ago, that wasn't happening. And about 2 or 3 months ago, it's like 50% of conversations, it seems like, out there in the public are something related to AI. And it keeps coming up. I know we talked a little bit about this with our intro call. But how is AI affecting clinical and medical research, especially with tools like OpenAI, UpToDate, and other AI-enabled research platforms? Also, Open Evidence, which most, I mean, you need an NPI number to have access to it. At least that's my understanding. So it's available to physicians and advanced practice providers. Like, I don't know if the nurses have, I guess I don't know exactly who else can have access to it.
Yeah, great question. And yeah, how AI will impact, each of our professions and vocations and the workflows that we have. That's like the million-dollar question that's on everybody's mind. And I am constantly playing with these tools and seeing like, what do they do well? What do they miss? What are their blind spots? And like the tools that you mentioned, they my impression was that they're great for like the 30,000 foot view. If you're not too familiar with this back, this patient, this disease or procedure, they're a great way to get started. But it misses a stuff around the edges and a lot of nuance. And that was kind of my feeling, but I wanted to test that because, I'm not a clinician. I don't have the level of training experience you do, Brian. So I had a bunch of these tools do kind of a little brief or an output. And I found specialists that I know, like this is their world. They're very caught up and immersed in that literature. So it was one was a GI doc, and another was an oncologist. And I just gave them the output. I didn't tell them where it came from. And I said, "What do you think of this little brief?" And they said, "Yeah, it got the gist right. It was pretty good. It missed a lot, and then in the or a little around the edges and some details. But then in the references, they're like, There actually was a really good systematic review 6 months ago that answered this question pretty well, and that wasn't included.
Oh,
Or
wow.
we don't use this term anymore. That went out of vogue like 7 months ago. We've kind of shifted our understanding and expanded a little bit. So yeah, their feeling was that it's pretty good. It's a good place to start. You know, it gives you a good background, but if you're gonna make like a really big like patient decision, you know, care decision, don't rely just on what AI has told you. You know, you're gonna wanna do your own searching, pull on your own expertise and training, talk to colleagues, all of those things that folks used to do before AI. So
Yeah. And obviously, a place for somebody like you to kind of come in. Somebody can get up to speed, attorneys can get up to speed on a topic, but if they really want to get down and deep into it, they're really gonna need to bring in somebody. I mean, they use experts for everything else. I mean, your expertise is but one another expertise that I think is very underutilized by attorneys and law firms in these big cases. So we talked about AI, where you think out of like OpenAI, up to date, is there one that you think is sort of the best one to go to? I mean, if somebody's going to go to one, where do you think they should go? I tend to like Open Evidence, but excuse me. I tend to like Open Evidence, but you know, there, but that's my own bias.
Yeah, Open Evidence is pretty good, and then also UpToDate is pretty good. That was an incredible tool before, you know, they inserted AI. And so for folks who don't know, you know, they would send a specific entry on a disease or procedure or something off to like some of the top folks in the country and say, hey, update our chapter on this or see, you know, if any of these things have changed. And they would do it several times a year and it'll tell you like this was updated last month. And then it'll link to their citations. And so that tool is pretty much one of the go-tos. I know it's so expensive. But if, you know, we've ever tried to cut it, like at our healthcare system, you know, the physicians have rioted. They're like, we have to have this. You know, we love,
It's yeah, it's built in a lot of our electronic health records. It's actually built into Epic. You know, I'm pretty sure in ours, it really is. It's you know, people that may not, it's basically the Wikipedia of everything medicine, but it's not written by somebody off the street that can change it on a whim like Wikipedia. It's written by the experts they hire, they pay, they procure the best people in that field. So, but one of the things I found is there are big topics, but when you get really granular into a topic, they just don't have, you know, like, you know, you're talking about a specific procedure with a specific instrument. Well, there's no way you're gonna get that. You're gonna get topics like, you know, perineal arterial ischemic stroke and the workup and you know the workup and treatment of that, or neonatal seizures, and you know these are all things that are sort of near and dear to what I do clinically on a regular basis. As far as attorneys and experts, LNCs, what should they be cautious about when using AI-generated medical summaries? So we talked about where they may have shortfalls of not finding things, but where do you think people could run afoul in that area?
Yeah, you know, yeah, we've all seen the headlines of where people have just trusted it too much. So, you know, our reputation is everything in, you know, the medical legal sector. And if you're stamping your name on that, you've got to be really sure. You know, your product is 100% accurate. So, yeah, I'll see some folks. Yeah, they'll just use it for like trying to help them find, you know, literature or, yeah, even like just putting citations in. You know, I don't trust it to even do that. I, pull my citations right from National Library of Medicine, PubMed and everything, because I
Right.
would lose sleep over at night if one period was out of place. So yeah.
So yeah, kind of verifying, making sure citations are correctly and things like that. Yeah. And God forbid hallucinations. I've seen, I've just on the news seen like I think attorneys that have been sanctioned where they presented something and there was like as case law, I can't remember, maybe it was Michael Cohen or something a long time ago, and where they presented, and then the judge is like, I can't find this case law that you've cited. And then they go back and it's like, it doesn't exist. And I had something come up, interesting example. I wanted to see what ChatGPT could provide as far as I was going through, kind of doing what you were doing, trying to get an answer to a question and seeing what it did. So I put in a question. It was related to sort of hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy and what I do. And ChatGPT, and it came back, and a lot of the information was fairly correct, I thought. And it cited four or five articles. And I looked at it, I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And I was like, oh, they are sort of the lead authors in this field. I recognize the authors. And then when I went in to actually look up the articles did not exist. Those articles, there were multiple articles it cited. And so then I looked at it, I was like, it was smart enough that it sort of figured out what authors should be there. And they were in as actual authors in these articles, and the titles looked great. And the actual journals looked correct. But if you would have cited that and not gone and actually pulled, that would have been a nightmare.
Absolutely.
And I said to ChatGPT, I said, I looked up and you didn't. And it was just like, oh, sorry. Sometimes, sometimes we try to summarize things and I can't remember exactly, but I was just like, wow, that was so eye-opening in that the title looked good. The journals looked appropriate, and right down to the actual authors were the right people that it should have, but those articles didn't exist. So
Oh
anyway, that
yeah.
was my own experience, and
Yeah.
that gave me some a great experience, eye-opening. I've not seen that. I can be honest, I've not seen that with open evidence. I have not seen any article hallucination with open evidence, but I agree with you. There's stuff that it misses because it's open evidence doesn't have the entirety of PubMed. We're kind of coming to the end of our time. One of the things I want to make sure is that people can get a hold of you, Michael, because I think that's going to be really important. Up on the screen, we'll make sure we put up your email address. Can you let people know? Because a lot of people are just going to be listening to this and not watching it. What is your email address, Michael?
Yeah, it's librarian@grahammedlegal.com. And you can just Google Michael Graham, medical librarian, or Graham Med Legal. That's my LLC. I'm also on LinkedIn. You can, message me there.
How do you spell your last name, Graham, so
Oh,
that
yeah,
people
thanks.
make sure?
Graham, Graham, just like Graham Cracker. So, yeah.
Perfect. Yep. And where else? Did you say you have a website?
I do have a website. I also have a Substack where I do a weekly kind of case analysis of something that I found of interest, and it could be med mal or personal injury, and I'll
Oh,
kind of
wow.
post some, documents and things like that. And it's all everyone's, anonymous, and I change the names of institutions and folks and everything. So yeah. But yeah, and I do that weekly.
Awesome. And then you are obviously on LinkedIn, Michael Graham Research, and your Substack is at Graham Med Legal Research. So those are good places. Before we close, maybe just one thing that you want people to remember as it relates to medical. If somebody just tuned in 5 seconds ago, and this is all they're going to get, what is sort of one piece of information or parting words you'd want to make sure people hear?
Yeah, I would just say that, yeah, medical evidence and scientific evidence is so incredibly important, you know, to just bolstering, you know, your standard of care or causation or injury claims. You know, really, you know, we're supposed to be practicing evidence-based medicine. And so having access to everything in its entirety and making sure you are aware of everything is just, yeah, really important.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. Michael, it's been wonderful having you on. I think it would be great down the road, probably, to kind of come back. I think this AI is going to evolve. It feels like it's like a snowball that just keeps going faster and faster. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I definitely want to keep in touch, and mm-hmm. hopefully we can have you back again. For those of you listening, I really appreciate you listening. As always, it's super helpful, important, and we so appreciate if you like this, if you comment, if you share with some friends. We really appreciate the engagement. This is the Expert Witness Playbook, and we look forward to seeing you again in the near future. Thank you.